everybody, and welcome to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. Walker.
That's me.
It is our end of year extravaganza in late January. We are going to be summarizing the hits, the misses of 2024. I, for one, have put on my t-shirt with the fewest holes. I considered bathing, which is, you know, in advance. It's going to be a gala.
I have our traditional end of year pants on. I thought that was good enough.
I hope you didn't wash them.
No.
Good. Good. So we're going to be talking about the games we played last week. We're going to talk about the news and why it doesn't matter. And our topic is going to be 2024 in review. It was a fine year of games.
It was a fine year.
It was a fine year of games. You know, initially when thinking about Game of the Year, I'm perfectly happy to stand behind our Game of the Year. And about other things, I had the false impression, largely due to selective and imperfect memory, that 2024 had been a mediocre year in hobby gaming. I was remiss. I had the process of going through and winnowing down our personal top tens as well as Game of the Year has made me appreciate 2024 as a very solid year in hobby gaming. So, Walker, what did you play last week?
Mark, another crowdfunding game in called Under Our Sun, and I streamed it, so if you're interested, you can always go to our live channel and check it out. It is very much Robinson Crusoe, but in a post-apocalyptic setting. You're picking a character. They have special abilities. You have equipment, but it's not overwhelming equipment. It's very, like, sort of subdued. And then you just start spending action points to move out and do whatever mission you happen to be doing. It seems as though I get the feeling from the forms and the rule book that it is very loosey-goosey. There's a giant section right on the main reference card that says, write house rules here. So it seems as though this is an outline. Do what you will, have fun playing the game. And there are quite a few things missing from the rule book. Made it, trying to learn, a little wonky, but we still had fun.
Is this cooperative or competitive?
You can make it however you want. You can have a hidden trader.
It's but, very, well, it's the very main, pin low, okay.
Its main is cooperative. The main way to play it is Robinson Crusoe way, but you can add, it's just a straight up deck. You know, there's a bunch of different enemies. You can choose one of them. It gets shuffled with, you know, regular, and then you deal them out, and the one person has their own sort of agenda.
Yeah, because a loosey-goosey, make the rules up on the fly competitive experience sounds like asking for a bad time.
Yes.
Especially if there's a hidden traitor, because then there's kind of a meta game of negotiation about how far to push the rules that doesn't sound very pleasant.
It's very much Robinson Crusoe on steroids. Robinson Crusoe, you have to worry about food. A little bit of other stuff, like shelter a little bit and other things slightly. But in this one, it's you need water all the time. There's three phases per day. Every day you need water. And then at the end of the day, you need food. So you're running out of food as well. You also have a fitness level that's going down every day as well. So you got to keep that up. It's just a constant barrage of pain.
You and Huey were talking about the fitness level, and I think that's pretty emblematic of the rules ambiguities you were talking about.
Well, that's right. The setup says set your fitness level to good.
Seems straightforward enough.
Yeah, I don't know what that means. There's no good on the fitness track.
Put the marker or whatever, however it's tracked, on good on the track.
On good.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, when I find that, I'll let you know.
Oh, there's no good on the track?
No.
Okay,
no,
that's a problem.
That's a problem.
I see. Well, you spoke highly about the crafting in Under Our Sun.
Yeah, I think it's just at a very good level. It's not overwhelming. There's not, like, you know, 500 different things you can craft. There are like 8 different resources, and, you know, a mix of different resources are going to make different things. It's on that one large quick ref that I was talking about.
Under the house rules section.
In the house rules area. And, you know, they break them up into tools and medic and weapons. And so it's nice, easy to follow. And, you know, you're not, you know, constantly searching through to try to find something. And they all are semi-useful. All the tiles, when you turn up, they all like have a movement value, and so some of the items make it easier to move around. And we had our scenario was some of our people were kidnapped, so we had to go out and find them. It was pretty interesting. It broke apart there with the rules being, you know, because once enemies, every time we got to a hex where our friends were, it always came with enemies. It said, you know, spawn a couple soldiers, and when you kill the soldiers, you get your civilians back. You don't have any tokens for the civilians or anything. But then, unfortunately, if you don't kill the soldiers in that turn, they start to move. And usually there was, you know, 2 or 3 of them. So now you have 2 different soldiers. So Do you have to kill them both now in order to get your civilian back? Or kill one of them to get your civilian back? And then you find another hex that has another civilian. So now you have four soldiers milling around. Yeah. But only two
new ones
of them
spawning in, unconnected to the original event. Yeah.
And then unfortunately, when they do move, they might move off the map. And they do cover it in the rule book. It says if they move off the map, then just take, you know, one of the hexes from your stack and leave it face down. But then eventually that stack is gone. So now what do? You have no more tiles left, and now they're moving away. So we just decided that we had played for quite a while, and if they happen to move off randomly off the map, then they have taken our civilians away.
More power to you. Just get out.
Yeah. And that is Under Our Sun, designed by Maximilian Lichner and David Poulda, put out by Tabletopper Games.
I decided during this week to play as many games of the year as I possibly could. By which, of course, I mean the only Game of the Year award that matters, the So Very Wrong About Games Game of the Year. The other ones are garbage. We know this. And so I get to play Cosmic Frog. This is by Jenna Felly, Devious Weasel Games, So Very Wrong About Games Game of the Year 2020. And Cosmic Frog is, for one thing, complete gonzo ridiculous in the best possible way. It is not possible to play a game of Cosmic Frog without wanting to go into a deep dive into Cosmic Frog physiology and biology and backstory and mythology and cosmology. And it's just great. For example, the group I was playing with, it was Il Lupo, actually, who gave me one of the miniatures and said, "You're playing as a pooping frog." And I'm saying, no. Reyna do not poop. They are powered by a star which devours and consumes everything in their gullet if it gets shoved down there.
There's no waste, Mark.
Now, they disgorge.
That's right.
They disgorge like crazy. And if you're playing with the mental combat of Find Muck, they engage in projectile terrain vomiting. But they do not poop. Well, at least until Jenna Felly tells me otherwise. I mean, every once in a while she's like, "Oh, well, of course, this thing about Reyna." What the things that she's already thought of, as well as the things that she finds completely novel as a question, I find constantly amusing. Because half the time when I ask something where I think she's completely thought this out, she's like, "Oh, I've never thought about that." I was like, "Well, it seems kind of obvious in hindsight." Whereas the most esoteric bit, but then again, all of this is just to say that I do not think in the same way that Jenna Felly does, which is great. I don't know that anyone else who thinks that way. And it's absolutely marvelous. This caused me to realize that my copy of Cosmic Frog is incomplete. I have not yet received, or purchased for that matter, the Gluttony Packs, which have new Cosmic Frog powers. Some of the art on them is great, which is to say it's more of the same high-quality Cosmic Frog art. And I had that moment that you sometimes have in somewhat chaotic multiplayer conflict games, where I looked at the table, I looked at the board, I looked at people's vaults, and I said, things are not going well for Team Mark. And in many Euro games, this is both a benefit and a burden of a quality Euro. Many times you look around the table and say, things aren't going well. I don't really know what I can do about it other than doubling down into what I've already been doing before. Because there aren't really moments of inflection in a lot of relatively staid, low player interaction Euros. And that's fine. I enjoy me a good non-inflection Euro. But in Cosmic Frog, I was sitting there, I was like, okay, I'm in last place. This isn't going well. All right, I got to do something about this. I didn't win, but I came in second, and I felt very, very pleased with myself as a consequence, because it was precisely because I took the time about midway through the game to take stock of what was going on and decide how I was going to improve myself. And that was great. There's a message for life about this. I don't know what that is.
If you're not in first, you're last.
Oh, that's the message.
Yep.
Thank you, Ricky Bobby. So, Cosmic Frog was a blast. I adore Cosmic Frog. I think it has aged very well in the... Oh, geez, it's been four whole years. In hobby board gaming, that's an eternity, but there is still nothing quite like Cosmic Frog. And we mentioned this in the context of reviewing Thunder Alley. In the realm of multiplayer free-for-all whacking people in the face kind of games, whether it's a simple card game, whether it's a more complex game like Cosmic Frog, there are very few that stand up and don't fall apart under the pressures of the standard multiplayer conflict problems. Cosmic Frog is absolutely one of them. Had a blast playing Cosmic Frog. Jenna Felly, Devious Weasel Games, Game of the Year 2020.
Speaking of games of the year and multiplayer combat done well, we also played Ankh, Gods of Egypt. This is designed by Eric Lang and put out by Simon. And we played it three players. And unfortunately, it took me too long to realize that you have to play three players a certain way.
Yeah.
Because if you are fighting the leader, if you guys are head-to-head going up the victory point track and you think you might catch him, but you wait too long, then you're going to fall back to the last player. So you have to make a call at a certain point that no, you're not going to exceed the other player. You're going to be coming in second, and therefore you either A, have to start bumping up the last place guy, so you know you're coming. Unfortunately, that just lets the first place player run away with it a little bit.
Well, no. If so, here's the thing. What we're talking about is playing for the merge. And the merge is absolutely controversial. I respect that. Some people loathe the merge, and as a consequence, they don't really like playing Ankh, or they don't like playing Ankh if the merge goes down a certain way, or they only want to play the non-merge scenario. I think, first of all, next time we play, we should play the non-merge scenario, especially with three. It's a little bit broke. It's got a couple of additional details. That's one of the reasons why I didn't suggest it this time. But if it's the case that you're playing for the merge as you describe, you're not going to be letting the first place player run away with it. The ideal way to play for the merge is to give the third place player points at the expense of the first place player. If you help the third place player win more conflicts, that's necessarily points on the table that the first place player ain't going to be having.
As long as they're, you know, on board and not taking them from you.
Well, at that point, your score doesn't really matter, right?
True.
So, like, if you're heading into the merge and the leader's got 75 points and you've got 50 and the last place player's got 25, these are not representative Ankh.
So say that's a great feeling in a board game, right? Your points don't matter.
I respect that.
I know. I'm just saying.
I respect that entirely. But the thing is that if the merge is imminent, and you and the first place player start trading blows, let's even assume that you split the available points down the middle. That just means that when the merge comes, you have handed half of those points to the lead player and you keep none of them. But if you instead even just absent yourself and try to make it so that the last place player and the first place player split points down the middle, you're still making progress. And let me tell you, so as the player who is the non-merge player in this third player game, you guys were frightening. The merge of Isis Hathor was absolutely a terrible beast. It was only because I was sufficiently close to the end that I was able to pull it out. Given another round or two, your scoring would have been massive. And so I can definitely attest to the fact, speaking personally, again, I respect people who don't like the merge. I really like the dynamics of the late game that it introduces, but I agree with you entirely. You have to go in with your eyes open. And if you don't, yeah, it can lead to some bad feelings.
Just so. And that is Ankh, Gods of Egypt. It's got this interesting action selection where it has like a sort of a track. And if you pick actions higher on the track, then as a second action, you can pick actions lower on the track. And it all matters because once it gets to the end of the track, then special stuff happens. So it's this really interesting timing where I'm going to take semi-suboptimal actions just so I don't make the tokens go towards the end of the track, and yeah, the next players down the line will get to do the cool thing.
So as not to hand the event control to somebody else,
yeah,
or doing incredibly suboptimal actions just because you have to do the event, and sometimes putting someone dangling an event in front of somebody so they will do the action you want them to do rather than the action they should do. I always feel like I bite for that bait. I often spend far too much time focusing on the tempo manipulation of the action selection at the expense of my board position. This time I was fortunate I was able to pull it out, but that tension, that draw, is one of the reasons why I like Ankh so much.
You have all sorts of different minions that you get to summon every game. There's all sorts of different ones. There's tons of different gods that change up the game completely. I just like everything about Ankh. It's a very interesting game.
Yeah, next time we should absolutely try one of the scenarios that doesn't lean into the merge and or play at a different player count. My key beef with Ankh at higher player counts, which absolutely takes a little bit of the teeth out of the merge to a certain extent, certainly for the second place player, is that, number one, the dynamics of two and three players I think are really, really good. And number two, the downtime with four and especially five can get brutal. If everyone knows what they're doing, it's fine. But five player Ankh, when people take too long, can be somewhat torturous.
Painful.
Frankly.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. That's Ankh, Gods of Egypt. So very wrong about games. Game of the Year 2021. Got to play Trio. Trio is the English edition of Nana. Nana is a Japanese game. Nana meaning seven. And Trio is designed by Kaya Miano, published the English edition by Cocktail Games in 2021. And the goal of the game is indeed to form triplets. Cards go from 1 to 14. And you basically start flipping over cards, and if they match, you get to keep going. So I reveal something, then I reveal a second card. If they match, I get to try to go for a third. Failing that, I'm done. And the only thing you can do in order to reveal cards is point to somebody at the table and say, show me your lowest or show me your highest. This includes yourself. You may want to reveal that four, but you can't unless it's your lowest or highest card. Plus, on top of that, there's a small memory element, just enough to make people doubt themselves, of like, some small number of cards in the middle of the table. So those that the key element of chaos that they introduce is because they're not limited to the highest or lowest, you might in the middle of the game find an 8 or something, which don't tend to show up near the beginning because that doesn't tend to be people's highest or lowest cards. Now, there are two ways to play Trio. You can play the published version, in which case the goal of the game is to get to 3 triplets. Or you can play the original Nana rules, which are identified in Trio as the spicy version.
Ooh, spicy.
I, for one, was shocked that when identified under those terms, the people at the table did not want to play the spicy version. Who offers you Trio Caliente and you choose Trio Regular? That just doesn't make any sense to me.
Were they feeling all right?
I don't know. Anyway.
There is a flu going around.
Fair enough. Anyway, we played Trio Regular. It is enjoyable. It is wild. The other victory condition in both Caliente and Regular are that if you reveal the 777, if you get to the 777, you just win. But of course, the sevens, again, don't show up very early because they don't tend to be the highest or lowest cards anywhere. It is very simple, very straightforward, very much in the minimalist Japanese card game aesthetic, with a little bit of bluffing, maybe a little bit of memory, a little bit of chaos, but also just a lot of mileage out of a very, very simple rule set. I'm a big fan of Trio. I will play it in either its English or Japanese version, but I think all told, I prefer the Caliente version. The salient difference is that in the normal version, you win with triple sevens or any 3 triples. In Caliente, you can also win with any 2 triples that either added or subtracted get to 7. So, for example, a 2 and a 9, 9 minus 2 is 7, so a trip 2 and trip 9 will get you the victory. It's just... what I find shocking, actually, is that Trio actually has helpful reminders printed on the cards for the spicy version, and yet it's a variant. Like, they will say, on the 4 card, they will show the 11 at the bottom. And so those markers are just confusing unless you're playing the spicy version. I don't know. What I'm saying is, spicy is the way to go.
Agreed.
That was Trio by Kaya Miano.
Well, like I alluded to in the pre-show, we played more Llama Dice. We always play Llama Dice because Llama Dice is fun. This is designed by Reiner Knizia and put out by Amigo Games. And you have a random set of 6 cards in front of you, ranging from 1 to 6, and maybe some llama cards. And then you're rolling 3 dice, and you get to get rid of cards that match the dice you rolled. And if you didn't roll any that match, then you must take those cards from the center. There's always 1 full set in the center. And barring that, you have busted, and then you take all of the cards, and points are bad, and as soon as someone gets to 40, the game is over.
2 unusual things happened in our most recent session of Don't Llama Dice. One of them is there was a lot of busting. It's not uncommon to play an entire round and nobody busts, but we had several busts in the context of this most recent playing. And the other, I do not think we've ever seen this before, somebody won with a score of 0.
It's true.
Now, I mean, the fact that it's low is not the salient thing. As Walker said, points are bad. But I don't think, like, we've seen sub-5 before. Like, I definitely remember people winning with 2 or 3 points, but I don't think I've ever seen anyone win with 0.
Yeah, it's got this just right sense of push your luck, because if you get rid of all of your cards, then you get to get rid of a chip. And if you roll 3 llamas, you get to get rid of a chip. So there's this constant, you know, press your luck that you want to roll. You never know. You might get it. I love everything about Llama Dice. Super fun game.
I don't think it's the best Press Your Luck game that I've played. Not even the best Press Your Luck game by Reiner Knizia, but it's definitely sunk its teeth into our group, and I'm happy to play anytime. That is Don't Llama Dice. Finally, got to introduce some people to Slay the Spire, the board game. This is by Gary Dworetsky, Anthony Giovanetti, and Casey Yano, a second published design of Contention Games. Specifically, one of them, one of the Louis, had never played the board game before, but the moment he saw the box, he said, oh, I love that PC game. And I'm like, all right, well then, I don't really need to explain the rules to you. And it was just a joy watching him internalize how the different systems were being internalized here. So, for example, one of the things that we mentioned in our review is that things like lightning and poison in the computer game, which started out as 1 damage, stay 1 damage in the board game. Whereas in the computer game, there are a whole bunch of things that do 5, 6, 7 damage that are rendered as one damage in the board game. And this is to make reduce the influence of math and make all the bookkeeping much, much easier to take care of. Consequently, these powers just get vastly more powerful. Now, the game has been rebalanced around that idea, but watching Louis re-internalize how all the things work was entertaining. Like, he recognized all the touchstones, but at the same time recognized that the cards worked differently. And it was also great just playing it with Huey and the other Louis, who had already played before. It's been a while since we came back to Slay the Spire, the board game. I was very, very glad to get it back to the table. We played through the first act and successfully defeated the boss, and we are going to be continuing this campaign in the coming weeks, probably Act 2 next week, and if we're successful, we'll do Act 3 the week after that. Got to play as the Silent, which is probably my favorite character, but very frequently gets grabbed by other people. I usually end up stuck playing character types that I like less. That having been said, my second least favorite character type is probably the Ironborn, which is... I've never really been stuck with him because there are a number of people who very much just want to hit things with large swords. So that has not been a particular burden in this group.
Stabby, stabby. I heard it's an all right game.
Did you? Wait, no, it's not the Ironborn. Sorry, that's from Game of Thrones. My apologies. Not the Ironborn, the Ironclad.
You and I also got to play the Veil of Eternity with the new Artifact expansion. So Veil of Eternity is this very large deck of cartoony-type creatures that sort of spiderweb together, regardless of how you, all the different ways you play, all the different times you play, into these sometimes interesting combinations, like either based on the family that they're in or their point cost or how you manipulate them on the table, all different ways in order to get you points. And what Artifacts does, it sort of stabilizes a little bit by having these constant things that you get to pick one of every round.
Yeah, my chief criticism of Veil of Eternity, we reviewed it not too long ago. I think it has an interesting currency system. I like how it works its limitations about currency in. But ultimately, you're entirely at sea. There's no overarching structure that kind of grounds your scoring opportunities. And so consequently, turn order can matter a whole heck of a lot. Like, are you first in draft order that turn, that card that could really be the cornerstone of a strategy going forward, or give you a point bonanza half by accident, just exogenously by virtue of the cards you've already played? Or is it just going to be drafted out from under you? Who knows? Whereas a lot of other Tableau builders, and I'll naturally once again point to my favorite Tableau builders by Tom Lehman, things like Race for the Galaxy, and even more recently things like Res Arcana, have some sort of overall structure whereby you can be guaranteed some notion of points, some sort of baseline that you can work around rather than just, nothing really scores your points unless the card tells you to, good luck. Which, again, is fine, but it doesn't dovetail particularly well, I think, with the drafting and the way things come off of the random deck. So Artifacts and Veil of Eternity, precisely as you say, offer some kind of overall structure, not for point scoring, but more in terms of economic benefits and card drawing abilities and things of that nature. So it's just sort of a guaranteed supercharger to what you were already doing in Veil of Eternity. To a certain extent, I think this makes Veil of Eternity with Artifacts kind of neither here nor there. Like, it's not as structured, not as guaranteed, not as random as one of your solid Tom Lehman Tableau builders. Like, for example, imagine if, in the context of Res Arcana, the places of power were just random cards in the deck, and maybe they'll come up and maybe they won't. The game wouldn't really work. I'm not saying that the Veil of Eternity doesn't work, but I'm saying that that's the level of sort of unpredictability that is Veil of Eternity's sometimes strength, but mostly for me weakness. This is a preference thing. And Artifacts does not address that. Instead, it addresses other things with respect to card draw and economy. So it makes it a little more deterministic, a little bit more structured, a tiny bit longer to play, but doesn't fundamentally change that underlying chaos that makes me vaguely dissatisfied every time I play Veil of Eternity. For Veil of Eternity fans, it does have more cards, and the new cards seem great. So, kind of a mixed bag?
Yeah, the main thing I like about the Veil of Eternity is just the puzzly aspect of it. Like you said, the economy is very limiting. You can only have so many money tokens in front of you, regardless of their value. And you are sort of drafting cards, but you don't have to take them right away. You have like options of what you're going to do with them. So you can manipulate that money system in a way where you spend some of it and then you get some of it back and then you spend more. And so it's this interesting puzzle of when you're going to do certain things and to get all the cards out that you want. You can only have a certain number of cards in your field at any time based on the round number. Lots of things to like, but sometimes it just seems to fall away at the end. definitely has an advantage for people who've played it before. They know what the cards can do. They know, you know, some are better than others. You know,
yeah, you can set yourself up for more scoring opportunities. Yeah.
Yeah, like that gets you a point, you know, if this happens and you know that's not that great a deal, you just leave it and you know other cards are better anyway.
Right.
This is designed by Eric Hong and put out by Mandu Games, The Veil of Eternity.
Those are the games we played last week. Now onto the news and why it doesn't matter. So once again, if you know anyone who's lost any games in the West Coast fires, we know that this is not the primary focus. Restoring one's game collection when you've lost your entire home, obviously, is not the key priority. I respect that. But it is nonetheless a priority, and it is the one that I can hope to address. I've had a number of people very kindly come out of the woodwork to volunteer their access to their collections as well. So if it is the case that you know anybody, if you know somebody that has lost their game collection, try to think of some of their favorites. Just let me know. I'll start accumulating them. Even if there's not a place to send it yet, don't worry. We'll take care of it. This is going to be a months-long project, obviously, at a minimum. Just want to let you know. Our hearts go out to everyone who's lost anything in the fires on the West Coast. And this is the very, very, very tiny, borderline minuscule contribution that we can make. But it is one we do happily.
It's true. People make me cry. It's like, we say we're going to give away games. So the emails start coming in. And they're not for people asking for games. They're from more people saying we want to give you more games to give to other people. You're ridiculous. Get out of here.
We appreciate the assistance, and we hope to be able to repatriate some lost collections or some portion thereof. That is the news and why it doesn't matter. Now a brief break to pay some bills. And now on to our topic. Our topic is 2024 Year in Review. So, as per usual, we've got our personal top tens. We are then going to hurtle straight on into awarding the Game of the Year, which will result in no physical prize and no logo that you get to slap on your box, not that they would anyway.
For those Patreons that care about how I got to my top 10 list, there'll be a YouTube video available. I streamed it last night, so some people were able to catch it live, but it is now available on YouTube.
I was unable to due to technical difficulties. My sincere apologies. But anyway, and then we're going to proceed into our special categories, and then we're just going to wrap up on 2024. At least we got it out in January, Walker.
We did. I looked past. It's usually late January.
It is usually late January. There's usually a couple of stragglers that we want to get played so as to try to be... Obviously, these things are never definitive, but it does feel awfully bad when you play something in February or March. Like, wow, this is way better than...
I had set in my mind that it was February that we usually done the year review, but then it was mixed up with Board Game Geek. Doesn't put out their stuff until...
Sure.
Late February. It's not, you know.
Which is reasonable. I understand. Well, yeah, I respect the impulse.
I'm not saying there's any positives or negatives to it. I'm just.
Okay. So, Walker, what is your number 10?
My number 10 is Harmonies, Mark. I couldn't believe it.
I'm surprised.
There was some funny business.
There's
funny business.
That's wild. 10.
It wasn't even on the list, Mark.
It was 11. Wow.
And then I said enough. I don't know what Pub Meeple did. But I'm not going to do Harmonies bad like that.
Yeah.
So
I'm surprised.
I pulled Endeavor Deep Sea out of 10.
Really? Wow. Oh, is this? And answer me this: is this your bias against light games? Is this your feeling?
I don't know.
Yeah, Harmonies is awfully fun. I have a blast every time. It's so light.
That never came up.
Oh, okay. I was just asking.
I never went with it was too light. I did go with I enjoy crunchy things a bit more.
Fair enough.
But while I was doing the stream, I never said that. I tried to.
I am very surprised that Harmonies only made it to 10.
It's sort of my darling of the year. I think it's just very interesting. I love the art. I love everything about Harmonies. Easy to teach. There's no fiddly bits. Everything comes together. The flow is great. There's nothing I can say that is wrong with Harmonies. It is the complete package. My number 10.
My number 10, Walker may roll his eyes, is Black Rose Wars Rebirth. If it's an expand alone with sufficiently different rules, I am absolutely going to include it as... It's an expand alone and it changes the rule set.
Uh-huh.
It is, indeed. Consolidating the spells is trivial, but consolidating the room tiles is difficult, and thus I think it is worthy of consideration. And I talked before in the context of Cosmic Frog, multiplayer free-for-all bashing people in the face is very, very hard to do well. The other game of this ilk that we very much enjoy is indeed Black Rose Wars. I've not played enough Black Rose Wars. I really want to play more. And Rebirth is another solid offering. I don't really stand behind a lot of what Ludus Magnus does, but Black Rose Wars is a success. Number 10, Black Rose Wars Rebirth.
My number 9 is a crowdfunding project called Terminus, where you're building a subway system or a rail system around a city, and then you're filling in the blanks, like infrastructure, buildings and stuff that give you special abilities, and you're putting out stations, and it has this very interesting rondel system where you're going around and you're getting construction tokens, and it depletes the pool, and then you're usually, sometimes people are taking small little, you know, going around the rondel slowly, hoping that that is going to replenish itself so they can swoop in and get some more anything. Lots of things I really enjoy about Terminus. I'm hoping to get it to the table more this year. Terminus.
My number 9 is a bit of a surprise for me. It is Battalion War of the Ancients. This is by the designers of Pocket Battles. It's sort of redesigned in an Osprey package with just historical factions. I've just been really enjoying every play, just finding out new intricacies of unit combinations. The dynamics of the order tempo is just fascinating and brutal. It's a really solid two-player game. It is sufficiently good, and I'm sufficiently pro Battalion War of the Ancients that I'm inclined to try the four-player version and see if it's worth playing. I just really like how every decision is super tense and difficult, and you find yourself in a position where there are Pyrrhic victories. You could have engaged in a charge that said, ha, I did lots of casualties, and looked down at the ruin of your own mistakes. And so being able to overcommit like that is very much a characteristic element of ancient warfare, as I understand it. And I think that's one thing that that Battalion War of the Ancients models really well. So that's my number 9, Battalion War of the Ancients.
Number 8 for me is The Gang. This is a card game. It is a cooperative Texas Hold'em poker game where, during each phase, like after the flop, then the river, and then the turn card, you are betting. And there's like one chip per player, and they're all sort of ranked. So you take number 1, you are feeling as though your hand is the most powerful. And then once the final round happens, you sort of can look at the chips in front of people and sort of sense how the hand has progressed and hope that you get that last round bet right. And then it has special powers if you're winning or failing, and lots of things to like about The Gang. I really enjoy The Gang.
My number 8 is War Story Occupied France. This is the solo narrative World War II game designed by Dave Neal and David Thompson. And I've been having a great time with it. I've played through all the scenarios of the Maquisards of World War II France. It's got a really good combination of solid paragraph-based choose-your-own-adventure with these strange action set pieces that get to be somewhat bespoke. They kind of set up their own rules as they go along, but because it's a solo experience, that's fine. You don't need to worry about being fair to the Wehrmacht or being fair to... It's you don't really know what you're doing. You're just kind of planning an exigency and hoping that your decisions will turn out well, which does kind of capture the feel of being hopelessly outgunned and outmanned and in a far over your depth, as many of these freedom fighters were. It has been a great experience, and it is my favorite offering from David Thompson this year. That is War Story Occupied France, my number 8.
My number 7 is Windmill Valley. This is from the designer of Barcelona. It's the overall production is fantastic. It's super colorful. You are planting tulips, and so that's fun and colorful, and it has this great sort of Praga Kaput Rigny. You're turning this windmill, and then it has crusaders on top of that where you can upgrade all the sections of this windmill. And as two sections come together, you get to choose one, but then a lot of the upgraded sections will let you do both. And then you're doing, like I said, the tulips, you're getting employees, you're putting out windmills, you're doing all sorts of things. Lots to like about Windmill Valley.
No crossovers yet. I'm curious. We'll keep track of these things. Number 7 for me is Iron Forest. I am always delighted by a dexterity game that gets the components right and gets the rule set right. This is a rare combination, a rare confluence of solid materials and fun toys to play with on top of a well-done rule set and scenario system. My only misgiving about Iron Forest is that it is a little inflexible in terms of player count, and I constantly have to refigure out how to assemble the board every time I do it. I should just think of a better system of stickers so that it's no longer busting my head wide open every time I have to rethink about it. But I've been having a great time with Iron Forest. Just wish it were a little more flexible. Iron Forest, number 7.
My number 6 is Fromage. This is another game we very much enjoyed this year. It's this giant sort of cheese wheel in the middle that turns, and it's a game where you have three workers and you have to decide how powerful an action you want to do, because they're going to be gone for, there's like, you know, level one, two, or three, and they're going to be gone for that many turns.
Aging like a fine cheese.
Aging fine cheeses. So you have to either do a bunch of ones, so you have this like constant cycle back, or, you know, take the hit and do like a three, and then work with only two workers for a couple turns, and then you have all these different buildings that you can draft that'll change the game up every time. Four mini games going on, lots of things to do, and it does not last long. The flow is real. Everyone's doing things at the same time. Everyone's doing the cheese, getting the resources, wheel turns, and then you repeat. Game's over. Everyone had fun. Then you're on to the next thing. Fromage.
My number six is Wilmot's Warehouse. Every time I set up Wilmot's Warehouse, I have the same moment of cognitive dissonance where it's like, surely this is not possible. It is not possible to take dozens and dozens of abstract shapes on cards, arrange them in a grid, and then by the end of the game, under time pressure, be able to completely reconstruct where each and every one was placed face down. This is not a possible thing. When playing That's Not a Hat, I can't remember what the identity of three cards are. I can't identify a grid of 35. Yeah, and then you do it, because it's a kind of magic, and it's a kind of magic you have fun doing along the way. It is a memory, storytelling, organizational game, and it has to be experienced to be believed. Number six, Wilmot's Warehouse.
My number five is Leviathan Wilds. This is sort of an Attack on Titan cooperative game.
With less fascism.
With less fascism. You have this nice spiral.
Well, depending on who you're playing with.
You have this nice spiral-bound book where you like cycle through all these...
In our group, there's less fascism, but...
Giant creatures.
Well, sometimes I worry about Louis, but... I'm sorry, is there a problem?
No, not at all.
Okay.
I'm just wondering, is it okay if I continue now? So and then you all have these nice wooden meeples.
You won't let me speak like some kind of fascist?
You all have these little wooden meeples that are crawling around this giant corrupted creature, and you're smashing crystals, and you're trying to bring it back to nature. So you're helping it, Mark. You're helping it.
Sometimes they just die.
Yeah, they have interesting stories at the end, and it's like whether it's saving or, you know, sort of, you know, falls to the ground, and you look into its eye, and you can tell it's thanking you for freeing it from its destructive ways.
That's beautiful, Walker.
I know.
Yeah. I'd say it's more Shadows of the Colossus than Attack on Titan, but six of one.
True. I think more people might know the former than the latter.
That's probably true.
Anyway, lots to like. They did a second crowdfunding, so there'll be even more content. Everyone has special abilities and special powers. The boss has a nice, you know, different cycle they go through, and interesting stuff happens. Leviathan Wilds.
My number five is Galactic Renaissance. This is the follow-up by Kristen Martinez after Inish, which I found interesting but ultimately didn't hang together. And Galactic Renaissance, I think, really delivers on some of the same promises that Inish had. And now it's in a sci-fi setting with beautiful little plastic busts of diplomats. My one major critique of Galactic Renaissance, honestly, and with this resolved, or with a slightly different setup, it could have possibly been a contender for Game of the Year, is that I don't find there's actually enough conflict in Galactic Renaissance. I mean, there's competition. There's tons of competition over everything. But I kind of wish that the conflict powers and the overstacking limits had a little bit more teeth. Now, not quite enough teeth in the conflict versus too much teeth in the conflict and unanticipated consequences and weird dynamics and throwing the game out of control, a la Inish. I will definitely take the Galactic Renaissance approach 10 times out of 10. But that having been said, I feel like perhaps Christian Martinez's third major design will be the perfect one. But so far, there's been great progress. I love Galactic Renaissance. I will even play it with five, even though that's not its ideal configuration. But I've been having a great time with it.
My number four is Undaunted 2200 Callisto. This is David Thompson's and Trevor Benjamin game. I just love the story behind it. It is the corporation versus the workers, and the workers are using just their tools and machines to fight against the corporation out on moons, because the corporation is selling back the very water that they're mining in order at higher prices. So it's this conflict. It has interesting maps. Unfortunately, it was plagued by some misprints at the beginning that just, you know, sort of pushed people away. And it sort of changed the Undaunted system to this sort of objective maneuvering game to more of like a firefight and concentration fire game, which people may like or not like, but I just enjoyed every plane. I even played a lot of it solo. looking forward to playing it more. I love the art. I love how everything sort of hangs together with the mechs and the vehicles. Lots to like. Undaunted 2200 Callisto.
Gotta say, there's been a lot of Osprey on this list, right? Between Battalion War of the Ancients, Undaunted, War Story, and now my number four, Imperium Horizons, another expandalone. This is by the same design team that gave us a game of the year 2023, which is to say Voidfall, David Tertze and Nigel Buckle. And it offers a wild expansion of the Imperium world, giving you many, many new civilizations to play around with. This is a civilization deck builder, and the way that it manages to capture some of the historical sweep of civilization games that a lot of other Civ games don't is one of the reasons why I keep going back to the Imperium system. Imperium Horizons might have ranked higher were it not for the fact that the major new mechanical innovation that it introduces, namely trade, it doesn't quite stick in my head the same way the other ones do. It ends up feeling a little bit over there. Expansions often do this, you know, the new board, the new setup, the new deck. It sits off to the side, and it's the one thing you can't quite remember because it doesn't quite work the way everything else does, and so you don't interact with it as much as you might like. Maybe that would go away with yet more experience with Imperium Horizons, but maybe not. And another problem, again, this is bedeviled a number of Osprey designs. Walker talked about this in the context of Undaunted. There are, of course, more misprints. I find them manageable in the context of Imperium, but a lot of people felt very strongly about it, and that I vaguely respect. But anyway, the combination of Nigel Buckle and David Tertze so far has produced a series of brilliant offerings. I'm a massive fan of the Imperium deck-building game, and Imperium Horizons is my personal number four.
My number three is Through Ice and Snow. So what this system has done, I decided when I was doing the Pub Meeple thing, I do what I usually do, is like, if I had perfect player count, perfect sort of setting, what game would I want to play over the other? And just, it made me realize how much I enjoyed Through Ice and Snow. It's finding the passage through the Northwest Territories. It is, it says it's semi-cooperative, but it is in a way, and it isn't. It just means that if someone falls behind, you pull them along, and you're going to get victory points for that. And I love that sort of mechanic where you can build, because it's a worker placement where the places matter. There's blocking, real blocking happening there. You're working within Inuktuk. You have dogs. You have sleds. You're doing all sorts of different things. There's lots to like about it. So you can build your ships, and so you know you can break through the ice, and you're going to be like sort of the head ship, and therefore if someone falls behind, and they might fall behind because you've taken the spots that will help them, you know, to make your ships great, you've taken those spots, so maybe they will fall behind, and therefore you're towing them, getting the victory points. Anyway, lots to like Through Ice and Snow. Semi-historical. The production was great. I just very much enjoyed it.
Should play that more. Only played it the once. I should play more of Through Ice and Snow. My number three is our first crossover. I'm amazed. In past years, there have been vastly more crossover, which I think I...
Yeah, it leads to what you said. It was a good...
It was a pretty good year, all told. My number three is Leviathan Wilds. I am a massive fan of how smooth it is, and at the same time, it's bursting with personality. Very often, a lot of games, in order to chrome up and convey the setting or convey the narrative or give you a sense of unique powers, they end up burdening the system past where it might want to go. I mean, even Black Rose Wars does that. I mean, Black Rose Wars kind of creaks under the weight of its own rule system. But Leviathan Wilds is remarkably clean, and you still get to do lots of cool stuff. Sometimes it's just hunting around and just throwing action points at reducing the die. At the end of the day, the fundamental victory conditions are perhaps the least interesting part about Leviathan Wilds. But overall, it is a great package, and every time I play, I get to see and experience something new and kind of cool. And thus, I am very pleased to have played Leviathan Wilds. Thank you for introducing me to it, and I'm looking forward to more. That's my number three, Leviathan Wilds.
My number two is also another crossover. This is Wilmont's Warehouse, and I enjoy it just because it just is something so new and refreshing. It's like it's got the same feel as That's Not a Hat. You get a group of people together and you say,
really?
We're about to play.
I don't
mean like in gameplay or anything.
I just mean
the fact that it's a memory game, and you get the group of people and you say, let's play a memory game. And then they give you this look. And even as you're explaining to them, the look deepens, right? And you're like, don't worry. And then the game starts and they're like instantly sold in both cases. Wilmont's Warehouse is fantastic. You're creating this story. You know, you're sending people to the rave. They got to meet Rave Bay. It's all of these things happen. Then the Pope comes, and oh my God. Anyway, lots to like. Wilmont's Warehouse, like you said, there's a magic there. And I enjoy interacting with that magic every time.
Next crossover, my number two is Fromage. I have very much been in the mood this year for clean Euros. I've just been a little bit fed up with some of the overcomplicated ones. And Fromage was just a breath of fresh air. And just how straightforward the trade-offs are. And the trade-offs are in terms of actual decision-making rather than something complicated like a supply chain, getting the resources together before you spend them. No, it's more a question of how much do you need to commit to take this thing now? Because that's the only time scale you need to worry about, now and the future, not what you did five turns ago. Because by that point, you've already got that cheese. You've already cashed that cheese in. That was yesterday's cheese.
That's old cheese.
You need to worry about tomorrow's cheese.
Fresh cheese.
Yeah. Loved Fromage. Looking forward to Formaggio to get some of the hard Italian cheeses, because that's more my wheelhouse. No pun intended for cheese wheel. No, that was entirely accidental, I assure you. Fromage.
So my number one is Tidal Blades 2 Rise of the Enfolders. Why? Because I'm not known for playing solo games. I hardly play any. And I'm also known for, you know, dumping on campaign games and saying that, you know, they're just nothing new anymore. And this is a game that I played by myself more than any other game that, you know, I ever have. I have three different campaigns on the go. I have played tons of Tidal Blades, The Unfolders. It's such a bright and refreshing look on dungeon crawling games. You have like tight, you know, this nice aqua blue beaches. You have a unique character set that's totally different. You know, no more barbarian, elf, wizard garbage.
A barbarian elf wizard garbage. Is that some kind of golem? Like a trash golem?
Just so.
Okay.
And I don't mind. There's this, they call it the Nexus, and it's how you do your actions. It's sort of, it's like a pseudo deck builder, you could say. You know, as your characters level up, you're choosing cards that go into your deck. You draw your hand, and then you're placing them in this 3x3 grid. And there's some printed on the mat, like very minor power. So when you play the card, you either do the line or the column. And you do all of those actions. It's very interesting monsters. It has the same problem with some of the scenarios are kind of wonky. But I'm going to try to get to the end and just give an overview. We'll see how it goes. Looking forward to playing more Tidal Blades 2.
My personal number one is kind of a mirror image of that. I, too, am sick to death of campaign games. I, too, am sick to death of app-driven games. And my personal favorite game of the year was an app-driven campaign game, Fate Forge Chronicles of Khan. This takes the dice mechanisms of Vengeance and really streamlines them into a cooperative, well, it's not even a dungeon crawl because there's lots of different scenarios that you go through. And I have been shocked at the fact that I want to keep going. I'm still in the mood to read more app-driven stuff because something about reading from a phone in playing a board game that just turns me off. But nonetheless, the world of Fate Forge I find sufficiently interesting, not entirely unlike Walker's digression about Tidal Blades. I find the world of Khan to be full with enough personality and different enough from the stock fantasy archetypes. The last scenario we went through was a little bit disappointing, and that's one of the reasons why our campaign hit a bit of a stall. That's one of the reasons why we haven't gone back to it recently. But one of my gaming resolutions for 2025 is to play lots more Fate Forge Chronicles of Khan. I've been having a blast with it. It's crawled inside my head. I still think about some of the imagery. I still think about some of the things that have gone on. And I am looking forward to more experiences with Fate Forge Chronicles of Khan, my personal number one of the year.
It is great.
Yeah, and I have to say, like, even though there wasn't a whole lot of crossover, very few of the games in your top 10, I was like, ugh, why? I mean, not even very few. No games. So, Walker, with all that said, those are our personal top 10s. We're now going to go into the one thing that we are forced to agree on every year, and every year, ugh, it's bloody. This is a joke. What is our game of the year for 2024, Walker?
It is Slay the Spire, the board game. This is a game that's based off a PC game, which is a single-player roguelite game that they've developed into a cooperative board game, and they've just done such a great job in that. I feel as though if Dead Cells came out before Slay the Spire, we might have enjoyed Dead Cells a little bit more.
Possibly.
Because it felt so limp and not fun, not very many choices, a little too light. I think Slay the Spire just did such a great job that it was just hard measuring up. Like, Dead Cells just had to go up against Slay the Spire, and it just did not come close.
In fairness to Dead Cells, Slay the Spire, the board game, had an advantage insofar as it was adapting what was basically already a card game. Now, that having been said, they did a tremendous job of it. I mean, frankly, if the adaptation had been sloppy, it still would have been a very, very enjoyable experience because they already had a solid foundation upon which to work. But the rebalancing of the abilities, the rebalancing of the math, the rebalancing of the structure, all of it is exemplary. People who love Slay the Spire love the board game. People who've never played Slay the Spire love the board game. If you hated the Slay the Spire PC game, you probably wouldn't enjoy it necessarily, but I dare say anybody with any appreciation for deck building broadly would have a great time with Slay the Spire, the board game. It's genuinely a winner. I love it both on its own terms and as a work of adaptation. It's fascinating. And I'd just like to note that technically, even though this is, no pun included, Game of the Year as well, EFGA is part of So Very Wrong About Games, and so technically we're all just copying Elaine.
Yeah, well, it's true. We all had to come together.
Yeah, it's true. So that is Swag's Game of the Year 2024, Slay the Spire. And I've been having a joy coming back to it. And I'm looking forward to finishing our current campaign. And it's just been great. So Contention Games, so far, has had two very different, very unusual releases. First being Imperium the Contention, the sci-fi card game. And they plan on reprinting that sometime-ish with expansion material. And I think that Imperium the Contention is shockingly good. And they've done Slay the Spire. This is a very small studio that has done two very impressive and very different releases. I'm very much looking forward to seeing what they do in the future.
So I have a note here. How do you think Slay the Spire measures up to Voidfall, which was our game of the year last year?
As in which I'd rather play, which is,
yeah.
If I had to rank them,
Because they're completely different. There would be no way you could compare them any other way.
I'd give it to Voidfall, frankly.
Gotcha.
What about you? Don't just ask the question and then
And then just go on to the next. No, I've definitely enjoy Voidfall much more. Mindclash sometimes hits it, and they just did it at this point. It's like very much like Anachrony. I would play either of those two games anytime.
Yeah, and that's not a dig on Slay the Spire necessarily. It's just that Voidfall is very... I love sci-fi. I love 4X adjacent type of things. And it's just a singular experience, and Voidfall is exceptionally well done. Slay the Spire is a very worthy Game of the Year, though. I feel no reservations about it.
So off that super high of Game of the Year, we get to drop down into the sewers of the worst game of the year.
Oh, well, just one, huh?
No, I will know. Well,
okay.
The title of the thing is Worst Games of the Year, I suppose.
Yeah, there you go. There's a plural here, unfortunately. I did not have any difficulty populating this list, I dare say.
I did a little bit,
Okay, well, that's good. That's good. So what do you got?
Well, I think one that we both probably have at the very top. We'll just cover that one first. It's called An Age Contrived.
Yep, nailed it.
It was a game that was contrived.
I see what you did there.
It had a lot of moving parts, even though it had magnets, Mark. Even though it had magnets.
Yes. It had little magnet buildings.
It still did not...
A lot of the components were great. The little magnet buildings were kind of fun. The metal player boards were not super functional, but at least fun in theory.
Yes.
Sliding the action tiles was fun. The ejecting the thick bakelite tiles, first of all, the bakelite tiles didn't have very representative or useful art on them, and they didn't eject anyway. I've already spent too much time thinking and talking about An Age Contrived.
It had this action selection that sort of floated down this metal player board that made the box weigh a ton.
Yeah, well, we had the deluxe version because I was stupid to pledge for it, and I was also stupid enough to pledge for the deluxe version. But imagine playing it without the metal player boards.
It's true.
That would have been doubly torturous.
Yes.
So there you go. An Age Contrived. Someone should take it from us.
I agree. It's a great game. I'd play it anytime.
Perfect. Game of the year.
Yeah.
I've got An Age Contrived. Next up for me is Andromeda's Edge. Just.
Oof.
Yeah. Just okay. A slog. Just a slog. Look.
It's true.
The promise. So, Dwellings of Eldervale had some promise. Promise, I think, that was better executed in Cryo. But even setting Cryo aside, there was the whisper of a good game in Dwellings of Eldervale. Now, is Andromeda's Edge largely on my worst of list? In part because of the disappointment I feel, because I thought that Andromeda's Edge might have worked? Eh, maybe. But I did not enjoy any of my playings of Andromeda's Edge. It was a slog, an unpleasant one at that.
My second one is called The River of Gold. There was a lot of hype about it. I liked the setting. I liked how it looked. You know, on paper, it looked like it might be interesting, but it just did not wash out that way. It was just sort of you were just burdened by what the game wanted you to do. You sort of had to follow along while the die says I have to do that. The board state says I have to do this. So I guess I'm doing one of those things, and off you went. I just did not like how it all came together.
I'm not going to go bat for River of Gold. I just found it tolerable. Meh. My last game for worst of the year. I feel bad beating on it, but people need to know. Picky Eaters.
I was about to replace that.
Kind
in
of
there.
A weird take that set collection thing, but this was actually a good year for take that card games. I'm actually going to be talking about some later. Like, you can do good things with that. You can do good things with set collection, like Good Puppers. There's vastly better alternatives to be had, and we did not enjoy our playing.
Yeah, and the theme, the potential for that theme and the sort of the setting and where it felt like it was going, and it just didn't even come close to getting there.
Yeah.
And lastly for me is a game called Unchained. It was mostly just disappointment. It was sort of like a follow-up to a game called Nightfall, where you sort of had all these chaining cards and it used the same mechanism. Also sort of had the same theme, but a totally different sort of setting. It was more like a movie monster type thing as opposed to, like, you know, nightmarish type thing.
I confess, I've completely blocked Unchained out. Can I remove all three from my list and just make it Unchained three times?
You can. It was unfortunate and... in all ways.
Oh, geez. It was both forgettable and super painful at the same time. It's like a trauma you need to excise from your consciousness.
That was Unchained. And those were the worst games of the year.
Negativity gone. We're done with negativity.
That's right. We're on to the best expansions of the year.
Expansions! I'm going to start with Aquatica Coral Reefs. We love Aquatica here at So Very Wrong About Games. It is a lovely little hand builder. That's what we call it when you have a hand of cards and you play them out and then you play another card to get all your hands back and you buy new cards that go into your hand. And Coral Reefs, it's not like qua expansion, it's not super great, but it's more Aquatica. This is one of those things where it's not so much what the expansion is doing and more that I love that there being more for Aquatica. That is Aquatica Coral Reefs.
My first is Keep the Heroes Out Boss Battles. We enjoy Keep the Heroes Out, and this just gives us more. Not only is it fighting bosses as opposed to just, you know, fighting the heroes, but the boss is rampaging through your dungeon at the same time, and then once you defeat the boss, you can now use it as one of the monsters. So a little bit of, you know, legacy campaign-y stuff going on, and more Keep the Heroes Out.
Legacy in the best possible way, and more adorable meeples. Keep the Heroes Out Boss Battles is absolutely on my list of best expansions of the year as well. It is extraordinarily well done. The basic bones of the game are simple and allow you to just have a delightful romp. And I absolutely love what Boss Battles did to Keep the Heroes Out. Yes, absolutely on my list as well.
Up for me is White Castle Matcha, and it just adds a little bit more. I think maybe normal White Castle was a little too tight. This loosens up a little bit. You know, it's not so much the knife fight in the phone booth. Phone booth is a little bit bigger. A couple more people in there. But
what about a knife fight in a Japanese pod hotel?
There you go. Just so. Anyway, you know, it didn't stray largely from the formula. It's just more White Castle, more stuff.
I should really try it. I still haven't tried the Matcha expansion. Finally for me, Thunder Road Vendetta Carnival of Chaos. This is the opposite of why I point to Aquatica Coral Reefs. This isn't so much on the strength of the base game, just how much the expansion did to vary up the formula. Because Thunder Road Vendetta is a race game, Carnival of Chaos is a multiplayer smack people in the face game. And it gives you lots of cool toys to play with in the form of the super weapons. At the same time, the tension of going and acquiring other things, it falls prey to a certain extent to a lot of the multiplayer conflict game problems, honestly, but it does a good job of varying up the formula while not causing the game to creak under its weight, and so it's a very good work of adaptation, which is often what I look for in a good expansion. And also magnets. It took a game that had zero magnets and now there are two magnets. There that is go. Two more magnets than it had before.
Twice the fun.
Twice the magnets. Well, no, not twice the... It's an infinite improvement over the number of magnets.
It's a magnetic loop.
There you go.
And that's why it's also my number three. It just takes a, you know... It,
oh, you're ordering yours. Mine are in no particular order.
Well, it's just the third one. It's not...
Okay, good.
It's not like it's... I thought they're not ranked or anything.
I was worried for a moment that I was broadcasting with a tryhard.
No.
Okay.
And it just takes, you know, takes... For people who play a lot, it takes, you know, just the standard, everyone moving forward in a straight linear line and puts you into an arena, not a dome, and you can move in all sorts of different directions.
What
and,
if it's a lightning
stuff.
Arena rather than a thunder dome?
No. Too close.
Okay. Is what direction is Tina turning? No.
Don't go there.
Oh, the lawyer.
We're gonna get in trouble. Yeah. I don't know why you keep pressing this.
Sorry. We got to go beyond this.
Stop. All right. Those were the best expansions of 2024. Now we're going to do the best game. So the game we thought that had, you know, good mechanics, had potential, but we just didn't like it.
It's well done. It might even be a game that we would recommend to some people in some contexts.
Yes.
But we didn't enjoy it. I love these next two categories. Best game you didn't like and worst game you did like are two of my favorite categories. I enjoy getting into this. So Walker, what was one of the best games you didn't like this year?
World Spanner Factions is on my list.
Legit.
I can totally see why people would like it. You have these Heroescape type, tons of different characters. You're moving around this map, going on different missions, doing different things, getting items and weapons, and this sort of all-out, you know, melee sprawl type game.
For me, the absolute best game that I didn't like was Arx. I was very much looking forward to Arx. Arx has got a lot going on. It's got a classic sort of Cole Whirly. You've got to keep a bunch of plates spinning at the right time, but you're vulnerable on so many fronts. And everything can collapse around you if you don't get all your ducks in a row. And I just find that frustrating and difficult to manage. And it doesn't end up feeling to me like it does to feeling like a lot of other people. People talk about the sense of narrative they get, the vision of a sort of galaxy-spanning empire and a notion of all this sci-fi good. I just don't see it. To me, it is an abstract combination of mechanisms that leads to often frustrating experiences. But I see that there's a lot of interesting stuff there in Arx. And for what it's worth, I still plan on trying the campaign expansion. Why? Because my bosses tell me I have to. And I'm even willing to try that, even though I haven't really liked Arx thus far. Because this is true of a lot of Cole Whirly designs. I see what he's going for. I see that there's a lot of good stuff there. It's just often it fails to connect. Not always, but often. Arx.
Next up for me is Andromeda's Edge. I've heard a lot of people say how much they enjoy it, how much they love it. I did not see it. I found it sloggish and mostly painful.
That's because it is sloggish and painful.
It took that awful monster mechanism from Dwellings of Elvale, where it would pull everything in and it changed it to someone upping their fleet and moving around and drawing everyone in and devastating everything. And it just made for an unfun experience. We played several times. None of them were enjoyable.
Yeah.
Andromeda's Edge.
We tried. I wanted to. I was willing to meet it halfway, but... Another game that was well done but really not for me is Spectral. Spectral is a very interesting take on simultaneous action and deduction, with a little bit of area majority and bluffing thrown in. There's this grid of semi-random cards, some of which hand out points, some of which hand out curses, some of which combine with other cards to distribute points onto other cards elsewhere. You have to figure out where all these are because they're all face down. And so you might find that, oh, this card modifies another card that's over there in the grid, but it might be subject to other modifications as well. And so you don't have a full picture of what's going on. I don't really like deduction of that way. Any game where you have to take notes, there's already a high burden, right? Unless it's fun paperwork in the sense of, oh, my character gets all these fun toys. I'm usually loath to engage in games with paperwork. Spectral was interesting, though. I just didn't work for me.
My last one is Unconscious Mind. It's mostly probably because I just played it the once. I can see the potential there. It might still be just, you know, one board too far.
Yeah.
But we will see. I'm eager to play it more. Lots going on in Unconscious Mind. You have all these like translucent cards. You're, you know, helping your patients. You are moving around a city. You are moving chits around a board. You are doing this over here. You're doing this over here. Unconscious Mind.
And my last pick is exactly the same category. This is Sankore, Pride of Mansa Musa, from earlier, very early on in the year. I do like Fabio Lopiano, but I tend to prefer his simpler designs as a rule, the one exception being Audubon, which is an absolute winner from him. He designed this with the Mandela Fernandez Grandin, by the way. It's just too many tracks, too many, oh, you can't do this because you don't have the right color worker, and you can't get that worker back because you need to do this other thing, which is a color worker you also don't have, and it didn't really hang together to me. And it was just a little overlong, a little too scattered, a little all over the place. Sankore, Pride of Mansa Musa, well done. I didn't really have any criticisms with any of the mechanisms per se, just really not for me, and I couldn't find a way to have it stick in my mind.
And those were the best games we didn't like. Now we go on to the worst games that we did like. So games that just fall apart, but the parts of falling of them falling apart is what we enjoyed the most.
You can't necessarily defend them, but that's probably because you're too busy playing them.
So mine up is a reprint of a Reiner Knizia game. This is called The City of the Living. I know you hated this, but I...
No, hate's too strong.
Too strong?
Yeah.
You disliked it, but...
No, I think it's fine.
I, for some reason, just enjoyed it. But mostly probably because it's like a post-apocalyptic, you know, defend against the zombies. You are maneuvering. You're trying to get the best balance of these skills. You're getting, you know, more vehicles and different buildings and it graduated token stacks. Lots to like. I still have it here, and that is City of the Living.
Yeah, it's a redo of Prosperity. I played Prosperity when it first came out. I played City of the Living. They're fine. I mean, it's just... Knizia, genius though he may be, has lots of games that are just kind of okay and forgettable. And for me, City of the Living falls into that. So I didn't hate it. I actually have on my list of worst games I did like as World Spanner Factions. I can't really defend it very much, necessarily, right? And I'm not going to defend it as a stellar work of game design, necessarily. It is a game of excess. It is a game of too many icons, but it nonetheless hangs together well. Of too many possible actions, but there's lots of stuff to read and do. You, while we were playing, actually, were skipping all the flavor text. I like all the flavor text because, in theory, all your crazy cast of characters from all different time frames, as well as science fiction and fantasy, are off doing these very specific challenges, like shooting an apple off of somebody's head, a la William Tell, or flying a spaceship through a swarm of enemy drones or what have you. And Worldspanner has been with me since more or less the beginning of my hobby existence, and so I have got tremendous enthusiasm for it, partially based on nostalgia. I can't really defend it necessarily, but it is very much more Worldspanner than any other non-Worldspanner has ever been. I don't think I would defy anyone to challenge me on that one.
My last one, only because I only have two in this category, is that there's nothing wrong with the game. It's just the genre it's in and its name, it's just going to get a bad rap and people are going to hate it, but I think they did a great job. This is G.I. Joe Battle for the Arctic Circle. So first of all, you just say Axe and Allies and people are already rolling their eyes. And then you say G.I. Joe Axe and Allies and then they're right out. But I enjoyed everything about this. They have different scenarios. I like how they incorporated the units and they have leaders that have powers as well. Lots of things that I enjoyed about G.I. Joe Battle for the Arctic Circle. And everyone that played it also very much enjoyed it. So,
okay, well, fine.
I like my toys.
That's fine. You can have your toys.
Stop judging me.
Too late. I'm going to shout out Valka. Valka is one of those take that combat-y card games you have not played at Walker. Okay. Where there was a solo campaign-ish type thing that I did not enjoy, but there's a multiplayer free-for-all. That is utter madness and chaos. And I frankly enjoyed it. I got a fair amount of kick out of it, despite the fact that it leans into all kinds of problems. It does avoid some of them. Like, when you initially read the rules and you learn that you only get points for kills, you start wondering about how that's going to fall apart. It actually works pretty well, because you just... Now the challenge is to arrange your fighters to be able to knock somebody out in a combo and don't leave anyone injured. But then there's a whole bunch of one-shots that are wildly powerful and weird surprises and random draw things. It's enjoyable, though. I got a kick out of playing Valka multiplayer free-for-all, and it is totally the kind of thing that I would pull out for beer and pretzels nonsense and violence for people who are so inclined for that. I'm not, however, going to necessarily defend it as a well-designed piece of hobby material. And finally, for me, the last game that I'm going to shout out in this category is Avatar: The Last Airbender, Aang's Destiny. It is so easy to make a mediocre deck builder that is functional. And indeed, Avatar The Last Airbender did mostly that. It is just, here's standard deck building mechanisms, and let's color some of them for people you recognize in the cartoon and call it a day. It's not particularly evocative. If you're not familiar with the source material, it's not going to connote anything to you. But nonetheless, as a fan of the material and as a fan of mediocre deck builders, I thought it was getting the job done.
Yeah, like, and there's not a big field for cooperative deck builders either, and I thought they did a fairly good job.
Well, more and more all the time. I mean, cooperative deck building, it used to be novel, but now it's a pretty well-trod design space.
And that is the worst game you did like. Next up is our biggest disappointments of the year.
Sadness. I said we were moving straight on into positivity. I guess I was wrong. There's room for negativity here, Walker.
Speaking of negativity, Mark.
Yes?
Freedom 5, a Sentinels Comics board game.
Oh, yeah.
Now, we really love Sentinels the card game, and it goes into the previous category every time we talk about it. It's a game that shouldn't work, that is all over the place, but just hangs together, and we have a super fun time playing it. They said they're going to do a board game, and we're going to get painted figures of our favorite heroes. They did deliver on that. The figures are fantastic. The game, it is just a poor version of Pandemic.
Yeah. It is very nearly in my worst of the year, but it absolutely belongs in disappointments. I didn't really have high hopes for Freedom 5, but at a minimum, I was kind of assuming in the background that it was going to feel evocative of superhero dumb at least a little bit, the way Sentinels of the Multiverse does as at its best. It does not do that, and everything is just dull and sluggish and not particularly engaging. The only thing good about Freedom 5, I would say, are the pre-painted figures. They are very cool. But I can't even stand behind the rest of the art. There's so much good art in the Sentinels of the Multiverse universe. But even the card art isn't very good. The board is difficult to use and not particularly engaging. It's just so disappointing. I came in with low expectations, and yet it still manages to be amongst my biggest disappointments.
Next up for me is Arx. You also said, for everything that you said, you know, we had Root. Now we're going to get Sci-Fi Root. Looking forward, this is going to be great. We have Kyle Farron art, and then it just did not hit for many different reasons.
Yeah, I don't have it under biggest disappointment, in part because I don't want to duplicate on this, but also because I think I kind of remembered that when it comes to Cole Worley, it's always going to be interesting, but you're not necessarily going to like it. And by you, I mean me in this context. So it managed to barely avoid the biggest disappointment for me. My biggest disappointment actually was a game that I don't actually think is bad, and that is Undaunted 2200. It is my least favorite of the Undaunted games thus far, and as you said in your top 10, it takes what is an objective-based game into largely a firefight, and I do not think that is where the system is at its best. You still get that beautiful tension between card activation and initiative, and you still get the beautiful Roland McDonald art and the same solid mechanisms. It's just the scenarios really lean into murder fests, and that I don't think is Undaunted at its best. And I confess, my expectations were very, very high because I love science fiction, I love mechs, and I love all the Undaunted games. I'm going to be sticking with the previous Undaunted versions, and if I want to change a pace from the core Undaunted gameplay, I will go to Battle of Britain, which is already very different, but I think in a much more successful package. So I confess, I was, despite the fact that I enjoy it and would happily play, one of my biggest disappointments was Undaunted 2200 Callisto.
So I didn't have high hopes this year, Mark. So I only had two on this category. So go ahead.
Okay, I think you're going to join me for this one, though.
Oh, probably.
Because I kind of broadened the category a bit. This isn't so much a game in which I'm disappointed, but just a disappointment of the year, and that is Burned. Burned from Stone Circle Games was such a delight, such an enjoyable two-player hidden movement game with toys and doublethink and tension right off the bat. Supremely well done. It had two cracks at the crowdfunding apple. Just didn't cross the finish line either time, and I'm very, very, very disappointed that Burned is not going to be published, or at least there's no plans for publication at this time. And that is, I think, bar none, my biggest gaming disappointment of the year. Agreed. I loved Burned. It was so good.
It was good. Yeah. Well, we have a copy, fortunately.
We have an incomplete copy. And it's not a real game.
I know.
Yeah, it's sad. I'm just sad. I'm seriously bummed out every time. Like I've commented before, I don't mind that we can't move cardboard, but on rare occasions, I feel like I wish we could move the needle, and Burned,
And those were our biggest disappointments of 2024. Now on to our biggest pleasant surprises. Here we go. Yay! Unfortunately, you sort of, you know, I don't want to say bash down Spectral, but Spectral was one of my...
I didn't bash it.
I know. I'm just...
Not for me. Well done, but not for me.
But it is my kind of puzzle that I do enjoy.
100%. I'm surprised it didn't make your top 10, frankly.
I am surprised as well. When I went down the list again today, I was like, that and what was the other game you had on there? I'm surprised that I did not have Con on my list as well. But here we are. I have Spectral. Like you said, you're putting out workers. You're figuring out the puzzles. It's very puzzly, like almost a little bit like Almost Innocent. I just love that kind of puzzle.
Yeah.
I love what Spectral does.
Yeah.
And I hope I can get it to the table more this year. Spectral.
Sometimes the great thing about Eurogames, even after they've mostly been engaging in iterative improvement over the same set of core mechanisms for upwards of 30 years in some cases, is that every once in a while you get one that's just completely breezy, and it's not super different, but it feels super different. And that is why Fromage was such a pleasant surprise for me. I came in with zero expectations, especially since a lot of games about food have not really been particularly satisfactory for me. They feel kind of gimmicky in a lot of ways sometimes. But Fromage is just such a delight and so effervescent and joyous that I was completely pleasantly surprised. I was shocked by how much I enjoyed Fromage, even though I wasn't expecting anything of it.
Same feelings for me for Iron Forest. You know, it's another dexterity game. You know, a lot of them have been, now you're flicking blue discs instead of red discs. But this, you know, changes up a lot. You have the two levels. You have the catapults.
This disc has a hat.
This disc has a hat. Lots to do, different missions, different ways to play. Your mechs in a flicking game. It's great. Iron Forest.
I, too, have Iron Forest on my list, not because I expected it to be subpar, but because I had so many concerns about engineering. I commented a little bit about this on an episode of Bloat for our patrons, in that it requires a certain amount of hubris and chutzpah to design a game like Iron Forest. The launchers have to work, the pieces have to work, the boards have to work, all the tokens have to work, and that is before you consider any one of the game design problems, right? These are all just physical engineering problems, and they were all done in an exemplary fashion. Trust the launcher.
I agree. Trust the launcher. Actually, I'm going to go back, because now that you've said that, I can go back to I can get a third biggest disappointment.
Okay.
And that is the fact that Tiny Laser Heist came in and did everything I wanted it to do. The gameplay was fantastic. You had the hands, you had the things, you had the lasers, you had the stacking. But then, you know, as normal, you know, silly game or dexterity game does, they just falls apart at the victory point or at the close, right? It just did not do it.
My only disappointment with respect to Tiny Laser Heist is that it is so restricted for player count in a way that it is a real-time, semi-cooperative dexterity game, and it is hard, in my experience, to get that many people together. Like, somebody's got a disability, someone's got a palsy, someone doesn't like real-time games, someone doesn't like playing Take That cards, somebody doesn't like dexterity games. It's hard sometimes to get these people together. And that's my only disappointment. But anyway, setting that aside.
Sorry, I had to go back. Anyway,
you had to go back. Yeah,
biggest pleasant surprise. I'm going to put in City of the Six Moons. When I heard the concept of it and I got the package, it was everything I wanted it to be. I'm not even close to being there yet.
Yeah.
But the fact that when I look on my shelf, I know that it's something there I can always go back to. Looking forward to investing more time in City of the Six Moons.
I'm glad you took to it. It is such an audacious offering. It's not even really like,
well, that's
should that. I call it a game?
That's what almost like gets me angry sometimes, like when I'm reading other rule books and when you go on the forums and you ask a question and then they reply, well, of course it's this way, and I'm like, excuse me, let me show you this other game where there's inferences made about the way rule books are supposed to be written,
right?
And that's why we can have this game. Is sure. Because rule books are supposed to be laid out and written in a certain way. Anyway, I'm done now.
That's a very good point. That's a very good point. My last biggest pleasant surprise for 2024 is Behold Rome. This is the solo design by Joel Klipfel, who co-designed Gloomhaven Buttons and Bugs, which itself was an iteration on Gloomholden. Gloomhaven Buttons and Bugs, for what it's worth, is something that was just shy of my top 10. And I wasn't expecting much out of Behold Rome because there's a lot of 16-card solo games, but Behold Rome is just a huge universe of very daunting, in a good way, card play challenges. Every card is, in point of fact, four different possible cards, and you have to worry about whether or not you're at the right time in Rome's development, whether you want to engage in Rome's development, or whether you just want to stay in the early periods. It completely shatters my mind in the best possible way every time I play it. It is remarkably easy to just pick up and put away for a couple turns at a time. It is so well done. Biggest pleasant surprise for me is Behold Rome.
All right, on to the next category, which we have labeled the ones that got away. So these are just games that we haven't been able to get hold of, or ones that we just haven't had time to play. Believe it or not, I've only had one this year.
Oh, good.
And that is War Story Occupied France. I've heard everyone, including you, going on about how great it is, and I just have not had time to get to it. I do have sort of some silly ones here. Storm Raiders, the one game I'm very much looking forward to. It is designated as a 2023 game. Even though I just haven't got it yet. And Frosthaven.
Haven't heard of it.
We still haven't played Frosthaven.
It's probably not being good.
Yeah.
The ones that got away from me, Matt Gert's latest, Seven Empires. It's out in Europe, but it's not quite out in North America yet. So whether it's a 2024 or 2025 release, who knows? Beyond the Horizon, which is similar kind of European distribution thing. It's kind of sort of almost, but not quite, a redevelopment of Beyond the Sun. So I'm very much looking forward to trying that. And finally, one that I've got a copy of, but I haven't been able to get to the table, is another Hollenspiel design, Doubt is Our Product, the two-player game about the mendacity and manipulation of the tobacco industry in the face of attempts to be regulated. And it is one of those, I think, feel-bad games in a good way that I'm looking forward to trying. Just sort of a blast from the past when, hey, remember when there used to be industries that were bad for us that lied about it? Good thing we don't have that anymore. Anyway, moving on. So those are the ones that got away.
It's odd that they keep popping up every year, though.
Now on to best game we discovered from the past. These are the games that were released in prior years that we didn't play in prior years that we would just like to give a shout out to.
Paku
now.
Paku.
Yeah.
We talked about Paku Paku last year.
Paku Paku.
This year, Droll Polter was one that came in.
100%.
Another one I have here is Deep Rock Galactic.
Okay, yeah.
I've taken to it. Mark also enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's good.
A whole bunch of stuff just came out. I don't think I'm going to get more, but I have a feeling that it's going to get to the table again.
Yeah, Drow Polter, 100%, absolutely. No question about it. It is so strange and so enjoyable. I have here also The Loop, the time travel co-op game.
Yes.
Which doesn't really feel like time travel, but is a blast. Lots of really cool and funky artifacts to manipulate. A little bit of combo-tastic co-op gameplay. Very enjoyable, very well done. And a last one that I'm surprised you didn't mention, Hamster Roll. Because Hamster Roll is new to you.
True.
I played it a little bit a few years ago, but I'm willing to include it now because we've had being able to appreciate it with someone who genuinely loves dexterity games as much as you do, Walker, has definitely reinvigorated it for me personally. Hamster Roll.
All right. Best games we discovered from the past. Next up, we have the most anticipated games of 2025. But before we go there, let's quickly talk about those games we said from last year, the most anticipated of 2024, and what we think of those, Mark. So we've already talked about some of them, so let's go through these very quickly. We were looking forward to Undaunted 2200, which fell, I think, at about a 65% of what we wanted.
I don't know. I can't put a number to it, but
Imperium Horizons, which I believe you talked about.
Yay! Nailed it.
Dead Cells.
Yeah.
Tiny Laser Heist.
Yay!
Yeah, I'm going to give it like a
We've only played it the once.
We did. I'm going to give it a 95% hit. Only because, you know, what did we expect? We got what we wanted, right?
Yeah.
We got, the actual dexterity part, I think, did what we wanted.
And besides,
it to
if
do.
You don't say it's a hit, you will be smacked in the face by a tiny plastic hand.
It's true. Arcs.
Yeah. Really. Well, I was anticipating it, and it was very gratifying to see it. So there you go.
And Cascadero.
Yeah, that was... Yeah. I mean, it wasn't quite... It almost gets onto the disappointing list. But as I say, when you're approaching with Reiner Knizia, sometimes it's just not going to be...
I think it was mostly like, oh, we're finally getting a Reiner Knizia big box game.
Yeah, it was mostly a question of hype. Yeah.
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 And then one, you can tell me about it. I don't know. Dire Alliance Horror.
That was more, I believe at the time, I expressed a doubt that it would release, merely the hope that it might. And for what it's worth, let me just repeat that hope going forward. It is still locked in. It's one of those things where a company that may or may not be mendacious is like, oh yeah, it's totally the word. We're trying to raid your ship any day now. That and my Street Master stuff. Same story.
One day.
Maybe hopefully. Not.
All right. So now we are going to go to our most anticipated games of 2025. Give me one, Mark.
I've only got one, actually.
Really?
I'm trying to live in the present one.
All right.
Sure you're going to mention a bunch. And I'm going to say I absolutely... I should have. Well, I've got a whole bunch under our next category, which is one of your favorites, which is game you want to be so good, but no, it won't be. But nonetheless, my most anticipated of 2025. Actually, I've got two.
All right.
One of them is Avalon: The Rivenvale, because it is the next offering from the people who did Oathsworn. Oathsworn had no business being half as good as it was.
It's true.
And in a number of ways, it was quite radical for the campaign genre in the way that it approached player flexibility and leveling and things of that nature. And Avalon: The Rivenvale looks gorgeous. I'm hopeful that it will be great.
Once we do get Con to whatever end we get it to, I would like to go back and give Oathsworn another try.
Absolutely. It in Frosthaven. Any day now.
Any day. As soon as, you know, time comes back into existence.
Walker, if I could save time in a bottle, the first thing that I'd have to do...
Could save time.
Love Jim Croce. I unironically love Jim Croce so much, you have no idea.
All right, this one you're looking forward to as well as I am. I know it.
Yeah.
Firefighters on Duty, the board game. This is from Artipia Games.
What?
This is going to be a real time, much like their Kitchen Rush and or Rush MD.
Sure, I'll try it.
But you're playing firefighters, you're moving around the city, you're putting
Are
out fighters.
Are they anthropomorphic animals?
No.
Do they save animals?
On that, I was going to give you a fantastic...
Are the animals they save anthropomorphic?
I haven't looked at it myself, but you're, great news, Mark.
What's that?
The cover for Dogs of War is out.
Yes, I know.
Good. I'm so glad you're happy.
I didn't say that.
Anyway, moving along, I've already talked about Storm Raiders. This is yet another post-apocalyptic. You're racing around in a buggy and a plane and a sub, collecting goods. You know, pick up and deliver. I'm hoping it has flow and plays quickly. We will find out. The production is nice and high. We'll see how it turns out. I also have Line of Fire: Burnt Moon. This is a David Thompson.
Oh yes.
Entry. I'm surprised you didn't have it. Feels like it might be a little bit like Convoy. That's why I'm sort of excited. I enjoyed Hibachi, but it was a little, you know, rough around the edges and took a little long. There's a new one coming out called Hibachi Fired Up, which they say they've streamlined the rules immensely, so I wouldn't mind giving that a try. I'm surprised you don't have Good Puppers 2 on your list. Another version of Good Puppers with more dogs. You can either play it by itself or combine it with your existing Good Puppers. There's a Daniel Tetsini game called Transgalactica that looks marvelous. Like, just the graphic design is something to behold. I enjoy Last Aurora. You know what, Mark? There's some post-apocalyptic games. I don't know if you know what that term means.
Yeah.
But it means, like, you know, if the world comes to an end, post-apocalyptic. Anyway, so I enjoy it. There's, like, a whole new sort of version. And so they did a great job with the crowdfunding thing. So it'll update that. It'll change the combat. That was the one bugbear that we, at least that I had. And hopefully make it more enjoyable for everyone else. So more Last Aurora. There's a super crunchy game called Sweetlands that looks adorable and I hope is super crunchy.
It does look adorable.
And Cyberpunk 2077. I know that it will be on our list next year for most anticipated and probably the year after that. So in 3 years, I'm just, you know, it'll be like the ongoing joke, right? It'll be on our most anticipated for the next 3 years. But Cyberpunk 2077.
It can be your Dire Alliance Horror in terms of maybe someday.
Maybe someday.
I'm very shocked that you omitted one of the... So you mentioned, we talked about Avalon: The Rivenvale. We talked about Line of Fire. The last one I've got on my list of most anticipated of 2025, I'm surprised you omitted as well. Regicide Legacy.
Of course. And the other one we didn't put on was Queen's Gambit as well. Is it not? Is that not the new? No, sorry, Queen's Dilemma.
Ah, yes, the Queen's Dilemma. Of course, I completely forgot about the Queen's Dilemma. Good point. Good point. Follow up to the King's Dilemma, and both of them, in the case of the King's Dilemma, it completely warranted the campaign structure, so who knows what they're going to do with the Queen's Dilemma. Regicide Legacy, I've got no idea what they're going to do with it, but then again, if they told me, oh, we made a co-op game out of a normal deck of cards, like, I don't know.
Yeah.
So again, very much in the same category as Avalon the Rivendell. This is the second offering from a group of people that produced Utter and Complete Magic, and so I am curious to see what they're going to do. So let's close it out with a little bit of Schadenfreude, or perhaps a little bit of bracing for impact.
Agreed.
Games you want to be so good, but no, won't be.
All right, before we go there, we're going to do a flashback of games we had in this category last year and how they actually turned out.
Sock it to me, Walker.
So we had Slay the Spire in there, and thankfully it turned out great.
Yeah.
Same with Tidal Blades 2. I was worried that it was not going to be good, and it was fantastic. We had Freedom 5, the Sentinels board game.
We were right.
And we're right. And Mark, talk to me about Mordred.
Mordred isn't out yet.
It's not out yet. Talk to me about Akron's Fall.
Akron's Fall isn't out yet.
I will now talk about Biohack. I enjoyed Biohack. It was very much sort of like a Wingspan, but you're manipulating creatures into these monsters. I enjoyed it. Other people didn't like it so much.
Wasn't bad.
Wasn't bad. I wouldn't mind playing it again.
I didn't dislike it.
All right. Games that I want to be good, but I know will not be.
I have Acheron's Fall again.
You have Acheron's Fall again?
Acheron's Fall. Look, you really want to play the new Star Trek game, and I want to play Acheron's Fall into the same thing. Like, the moment science fiction starship games get to a certain level of complexity, there's a sweet spot, which I think Talon did a very good job of doing, which is, I want to manage subsystems, but not get overwhelmed, right? I want to be able to tinker. I want to acknowledge that these starships are vastly complicated systems that have, power and shields and subweapons and various things, but I still want it to be playable and move along at a good clip. I'm hoping Acheron's Fall will be that, because it's the starship game in the Infinity Universe. I love the Infinity Universe. I'm just not particularly optimistic.
I have Imperial Borders on this list. This is by the same people that did War Room. It's going to be our gigantic sort of 7-year war, historical war game.
It's 18th century warfare instead of World War II. So I'm there for the historical enthusiasm. Walker's there for the design team.
I'm there, yes, for the epicness of it.
Are we getting the pushy sticks? Do they have pushy sticks?
I don't know. We'll just pull the ones out of the War Room.
Okay, good. Got to have the pushy sticks.
Yeah.
So I've got Elder Scrolls Betrayal of the Second Era. It is kind of sort of the pseudo-sequel to Too Many Bones-ish, maybe, who knows. But set in the Elder Scrolls universe, I have two reasons for thinking that I'm not going to enjoy it. One of them is Chip Theory Games doesn't have a good track record as far as we're concerned. And number two, early reports are that a single session lasts many, many, many hours.
Oof.
And so I don't know. You have to be really good to hold a gamer's attention for that long without it feeling creaky and laborious. But it'll be coming soonish, so we'll see. And the only other thing I've got is Rogue Angels, which is a...
Sounds amazing.
Yeah, it looks good, too. It's a sci-fi co-op squad-based thing. And again, we've got outstanding campaigns we need to finish. I don't know that we're going to be able to get to new campaigns. And the problem, there's so many ways it can go wrong. The scenarios could be bad. The writing could be bad. The campaign elements could be tedious. The core combat could be bad. But I'm somewhat optimistic. We'll see.
I promised myself I'd never talk about Finspan, but here's Finspan. You know, Wingspan is dictionary fine game.
Now
we have Finspan that they said is going to be a more basic version of Wingspan. And I just know it's going to be terrible. Warm Boy has got a copy, so I am just...
If there's a tableau to be built, Warm Boy will go and build it.
I also have Cyclades Legendary Edition on here.
Oh, yeah. Good call.
Good call.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think they're straying too far from the original template. Now, and I haven't played it in so long as it was like all through rose, am I going to enjoy it? Another one I have in here, it's like, why did I buy this? The Ethernaut, the board game, like maybe I was in my late, artsy European classic mode or something.
I remember you trying to rock a beret for a few months.
I even ordered the comic book and it was this weird feeling I got from, you know, it's written from this, you know, revolutionary, you know, against the powers that be.
Yep.
And he wrote this comic book in order to fight back against it, you know, sort of hide his political messages within this comic. And now there's
when I think South American revolutionary, I think Michael Walker.
Oh my, I don't even know what.
Look, Walker, we make fun of each other for absolutely everything with one salient exception. We understand that when someone shows up with an expensive thing they crowdfunded, we might ask what you were thinking, but we're not going to make fun of you. We're not going to go further than that. This is a supportive, welcoming place.
Well, let's hope that there is a game there, because I really hope there is, because the sort of feel behind it is there. I hope that there's a game. And that, those are the games we want to be so, so good, but we know they will not be.
And that's going to do it. That was 2024. I think it was a solid year for hobby games. Thank you for sharing the year of hobby games with me, Michael. I very much appreciate it.
Anytime, Mark.
And thank you, dear listeners, for joining us during 2024 and in this, the 2025 wrap-up of 2024. Thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it a great deal. Take care of yourselves. Take care of your hobby. We hope to see you again soon.
Wait, Mark. Wait.
I was going to segue flawlessly.
Oh, were you? I thought you were waiting for me to do the usual interruption thing. Sorry.
We do a usual interruption thing?
Yeah.
So I'm confused and you have no faith. Okay.
We'll redo it.
No, it's fine. Screw it. We're going to do it live.
Mark, what was your favorite movie of 2024?
The Substance.
Well, I had to bring up a list.
This works when it's punchy.
No, because it's not going to be punchy. The Wild Robot.
Take care, everyone.
Peace.
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Bickman. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. Prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.